We're so happy you're here this morning. Welcome to Philadelphia, if this is not your main home. I'm Emily Falk. I am a professor here at the Annenberg School for Communication, and I direct our newly launched Climate Communication Division in the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And I am so delighted to see all of you this morning and welcome you to this panel about bringing together art and the science of behavior change to improve our storytelling. And so today we're going to think about ways that we can bring together things at the local scale and the bigger scale. And we have experts on our panel who cover a lot of the key areas that we're hoping to explore, but we're also going to have a more interactive component after we do our initial sort of traditional panel piece of this. And on our panel today, we have Allie Sinclair, who's an expert in climate communication and the science of behavior change here at Penn. We have Alyssa Goodman, who's the photo editor for the AP Climate Desk, working at an international scale, and Max Chesneys, who is an environmental journalist and drone pilot working at the Tampa Bay Times. And so before we launch into the moderated discussion, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to just give us a sentence or two about their goals and a little bit about themselves for you. So we'll start with Allie.
Hi, my name is Allie Sinclair, as Emily just said. I'm a psychologist and neuroscientist by training. Broadly speaking, my research focuses on how we can help people learn and make better choices when it comes to climate and health.
Oh, now it's on. I hope you could all hear that. Today, my goals are twofold. First, I'm excited to share with you some insights from our research on how you can increase the impact of your work. And second, I'm excited to learn from you about what strategies you use in your work to try to tell stories and increase engagement.
I'm Alyssa Goodman. I'm the photo editor for the Associated Press, and I work with photographers, hundreds of photographers worldwide, to cover climate and environment where they are. And my goals for today is that you leave with a greater appreciation for what photojournalists do on the ground to show you the people impacted by climate.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Max. I'm the climate and environment reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. I also fly drones for the Times, and my goal today is to engage in a larger conversation about how it can be intentional, particularly at the local level when there is an increasing demand for content at a time when local newsrooms have been shrinking over the years. How do we be more intentional with our storytelling, particularly through a visual lens, and how can that message bring meaning and the possibility for change at the local level? So excited to be here.
Thanks. Do we have any other drone pilots in the room? Amazing. All right. A couple. Fantastic. How many folks are local journalists working at a local scale? Cool. How many people are text reporters? How many people work with photo and video in their day-to-day? Amazing. Alyssa, yeah. It's your people. We're so happy you're here. So maybe this will be something that many of you will already be on board with. But I'm going to ask Alyssa to just open us up and talk a little bit about why it's really important for writers and visual journalists to collaborate and some of the ways that we might do that best. I'm going to ask Alyssa to just share a little bit about some examples where this has worked really well and places where she would like to think about new ways of doing things.
Yeah, so I always like to stress that photojournalists are journalists. It comes after, you know, the photo part, but they're journalists first and foremost. And so a lot of these stories that I work on would never have happened if it weren't for that photojournalist, that they're on the ground, they're talking to people, and they're bringing these ideas to me. So they're thinking first, what could I see with this story? And then how can I get someone to help actually craft the words around what I'm seeing? So we try to flip the table from, I think, even a lot of traditional journalists that I work with, they first think, what is the text story? And then try to craft the visuals that way. For me, I'm always asking the photojournalist, what is the visual you want to tell? And in this case, this was a photojournalist in Kenya, Brian Nganga. And he basically, I gave him the ideas. We were working on a series on climate migration and people forced to leave their home for different reasons. That was all I told him. And he came back to me and he said, I'm really interested in an animal conflict. What? And he said, this woman I met, her leg was bit off by an alligator. due to rising sea levels, there's been more and more of this happening in this area, and she had to migrate with her family. And now they move much further away from the water. And so I thought, wow, that is an incredibly powerful, actually, story, really. And so he went, and he did a lot of the reporting and worked with a journalist, a text reporter, who wasn't even in that country. So sometimes we have to work with the resources we have on the ground there and then craft the story around that way. This was also part of our climate migration series, a family whose home was destroyed. I mean, the visuals from that are just absolutely incredible. You know, these fishermen who like to live obviously close to where they work, their homes are just being destroyed in Sri Lanka. And the photojournalist saw this and then pedaled back to what is the story behind this and why is this happening? And can you help me with some of that? But the visual spoke for itself, really. And then the last example here is really just a photojournalist who can do it all. Someone who can do photos, someone who can do video, and then someone who is on the ground doing all of the reporting themselves. To me, that is a rare, special human. And this photojournalist was sent to Tahiti. And obviously, the surfing for the Olympics is going to be there. And for me, I love stories that cross, you know, that aren't just purely climate environment. I come from a sports background, actually. So for me, this was a dream to work on. And we wanted to show that the coral reef being impacted by the tower being built for the Olympic surfing competition was actually happening, right? People keep telling us it's happening. How can you see it? You can only see it if you're under the water, right? The area was completely guarded by police. This photojournalist worked his absolute butt off to get access to the actual damage going into the reef. And we were, so far, the only media who's been able to actually really show drilling into the reef. And I think that when you talk about climate impact, you have to see it. And I think when you actually see it, you start to really, you can't deny it, right?
Yeah, thanks, Alyssa. And Max, you are on the ground making images and reporting at a local level. Can you tell us a little bit about how you think about some of these things and maybe a story of an assignment that was really important to you or how you approach this now that Alyssa's kind of set up the reasons why we need these kinds of images? Like, how do you get them?
Yeah, absolutely. And so my background, actually, I'm a text reporter first, but at the local level, you're often asked to diversify your skill sets. And so for me, that's drone photography. I'm a Part 107 licensed drone photographer. And that has actually given me a lot of opportunity to cover assignments that I wouldn't normally cover. The most recent example is Hurricane Idalia from last year. Idalia was the only hurricane to strike the United States last year during the 2023 hurricane season. It cost upwards of $3.5 billion, took 12 lives, and made landfall as a major Category 3 hurricane. So this is an assignment that I, like I said, I wouldn't have otherwise covered had I not had the skill set as a drone photographer. And to be able to tell this story, kind of what Alyssa said, you have to witness it visually. Because we can, in Tampa, we're in a very low-lying community. We're extremely vulnerable to rising seas and flooding events. A lot of our structures in Tampa are not elevated. They're at ground level. And so Idalia presented a very interesting case study because it was making landfall in a place that had a lot of natural infrastructure. It had a huge marshland in front of rural areas, and we wanted to communicate that natural infrastructure might actually buffer storm surge, and we could learn a lot from Idalia because of the elevated structures of particularly where it made landfall. Oops, wrong way. So a little bit about where the storm made landfall. It was in Florida's Big Bend, which is a particularly remote area. The communities that live there are all separated from each other. And I was dispatched with another team member to Horseshoe Beach, which, to give you a little sense of just how rural it is, there's a single road in and out of this community of 1,000 people. And so when you think about a major hurricane, this is a particularly wooded area. There was a lot of downed trees trying to get into the community itself. And so the day of the actual event, getting into Horseshoe Beach took about 3 hours because we had to move our SUV in and out of a lot of debris. It's a very high stakes mission because you want to get in there before law enforcement to be able to tell the story before they begin to control the message. And so it took us about 3 hours to get into the community, and we wanted to very quickly tell the story visually from above, because that's how you get a good glimpse of what the scale of the problem is when you can see it from above. But before we could do that, we ran into a roadblock, and that was that this one street in and out of the city was completely blocked with debris. And so before we could even get inside the community, we had to basically sit here while a couple of residents cleared the roadway so that the caravan of two or three cars could get into the actual community first. And so we were the only two journalists, myself and my coworker Kirby Wilson, were the only two reporters that actually entered Horseshoe Beach on the day of landfall. And we beat law enforcement there, and then they blocked off access. So they let us in there. They knew how long it took us to get into the community, and they let us report sort of unimpeded from any sort of regulations or anything. But immediately we threw the drone in the air, myself and Kirby. We huddled together under a poncho as it was raining, because the conditions were still pretty bad. Landfall had just happened about an hour prior, and there was still about 4 feet of storm surge covering the entire community. And these images are really, I think, important for us at the Tampa level, because what you see on the left is that a lot of the structures that were elevated made it out largely unaffected. Obviously, anything on the ground was swept away in storm surge, but they were on stilts, and the stilts survived largely. On the right, though, there was a couple low-lying structures that were swept away in the storm surge, scattered throughout the entire community. And so as a local reporter, you can use these images visually to communicate the message of resilience and adaptation to storm surge and rising seas. You can do that in a way that otherwise would be very difficult via text, right? You have to see these impacts to really make that connection. Just a few more images here. On the left is Horseshoe Beach's town hall, and this was a structure that was not elevated. The entire inside confines of the structure were wiped out in the storm surge. And then on the right, it's another example of a house that was not elevated. And so we published these from the scene to our Florida audience to communicate the message of this is the importance of elevated structures and as hurricanes continue to intensify with climate change.
Max, how do you deal with that when you see these images? I mean, just looking at them, and like you're under a poncho and it's raining, and like this is super intense human suffering too, right? Like, how do you handle that?
Yeah, it's this sort of sets the roadmap for where we continued our reporting in Horseshoe Beach, right? So we saw the most difficult or the most hardest hit areas, and we went there first. And so the first man we saw, Jeff Erickson, he was a resident. He's the only resident that stayed behind on Horseshoe Beach, and we found him coming out of his house after he rode out the storm. And we saw him because we saw him moving from above. On the drone screen, we saw his movement, and we were able to know exactly where he was and tracked him down that way. And so it helps inform that coverage at the local level and helps to target where you want to go.
Thanks. And so as folks like Max are making these images and trying to get them out really quickly, the next piece of the puzzle, right, is somebody like Alyssa trying to decide what's going to go with the story. And so I'm interested, Alyssa, if you can talk a little bit about the kinds of decisions you make. And actually, both of you can speak to this. But like, as you're trying to make decisions, you're taking all these images. There are so many different ways that you could tell the story. How are you making those choices about what visuals to feature, which ones to foreground? You know, something that's, like you said, Max, we wanted something that was high up in the air. But you could also imagine, like, if you're interacting with folks at the local level, like, how are you making the decisions about what to foreground? So maybe I'll let Max kind of talk a little bit about what this thread that you've opened, and then ask Alyssa to talk a little bit about, as an editor, how she's thinking about it.
Yeah, I think, obviously this particular example is more spatial, or you want to see the destruction from above, but I think...
Sorry, can I pause you?
Sure.
Because you said, obviously, this is like something that's more spatial. Can you unpack that a little bit? Because that's not obvious to me.
Sure, yeah. When you want to, from above, see just the expanse of a hurricane... I do think early on the best way to do that is through the lens of a drone, because it helps you to identify the hardest hit areas. But with the combination of text, as a text reporter, you can bring these images to your audience with additional context of like this is an example of a structure that has been elevated versus not elevated. But in terms of selecting images and the most appropriate images to use based on an assignment that I'm at, it really boils down to the power of people, right? And so, you know, as a text reporter at the local level, we have to, myself and my other text reporter colleagues, have to make the decisions for usually which visuals are going. We have photo editors that will offer suggestions, but it's really up to us about what feature image we're going to use. And so for me, it's what's going to engage the audience the most. Also ask the question often is who does my story serve? What purpose does my story serve? And what image that I'm leading with can bring someone into a story to potentially make change? And so usually that's human-centric. It's an image showing someone with emotion. We ran a couple other stories that day with images that I took of people that were coming out of their house, like Jeff Erickson, and across the Big Bend area that had just gone through this devastating storm. And so to be able to display that image or those images to our audience to not only spur up aid but also tell a larger story of resiliency, I think was really important. And that all boils down to using people, right?
Yeah, and can you say a little more about who you were trying to serve? Like, for example, with this story, with these incredible aerial photos, I can imagine a lot of different people. Like you said, you're able to identify somebody coming out of his house. Like you said, there's law enforcement there. Like who are you imagining that this story needs to serve?
Yeah, I mean, so Horseshoe Beach is an incredibly rural, largely unknown area, part of Florida. And so as far as we're aware, I mean, we've looked back that we were the only two to ever document aerially Horseshoe Beach and the impact there. And so to get those images out, I think, largely, you know, to a broader audience very quickly, it helps to communicate just the scale of the event, particularly in a community that's largely unheard of, right? No one really at the local level Horseshoe Beach doesn't have their own local newspaper, right? It's the regional papers around it that have to cover it. And so it's our job as the neighboring regional paper that covers these communities to tell that story to a national audience, to drum up aid and to drum up support, to make sure people know what's happening here is a very real thing, and these people need help very quickly.
Thanks, Max. Yeah. Liz, will you talk a little bit about the kinds of choices that you're making in your day-to-day job?
Yeah, in a situation like a hurricane or even a tornado, when we have photojournalists on the ground, they're actually filing directly to an editor like me from the back of their camera.
Can you pull your mic
a little
bit?
Oh, yes, sorry. So we often say within, you know, a moment of seeing something, the world can see it within 2 minutes. They're taking the image, they're asking people's names, they're voice tagging it, and it comes to me. And when it comes to me, images like that will come often in a large series, right? Sometimes 20, sometimes 30, 40, 50 images of a scene that I have to then decide, what does the world get to see? And it's definitely a decision I take very seriously, right? Because you don't want to make the wrong one because you want to tell the most powerful story with someone else's work, right? My name doesn't go on the content. It's the photojournalist. So I take, you know, their work very seriously in order to help promote the best content and to tell the story on the ground. And as you can see, we do it from the air, we do it from eye level, and often even underwater to tell the most powerful story. Often, though, I take a series of images, especially with longer-term stories that look very similar, and I try to pair them next to each other in groups and then incorporate the photojournalist in this conversation, right? It's not just me saying, I want this image, end of discussion, right? It's their work, so we always work on it together when we can, not in a breaking news situation. And I say, all right, you have three images or two images that look very, very similar. Now, which one are we going to show the world? So I think that sort of sets up, hopefully, a little game that I thought you guys could play, that I play with our own photojournalists on stories that we've worked on. In each of these situations, one of these is the image that we ended up choosing, and one is the one that we discarded. So in this case, this was a wonderful, powerful story about this community in Pritchard, Alabama, where they're having severe water issues. And in this case, this woman's home burned down because the firefighters arrived to the scene of the fire, and they could not get the hydrant closest to work. And so she brought us back to the scene. Her home, as you can see, parts of it are in the background. Obviously, within a story, we're not going to have both of these images. So I'm going to have you guys be the editor for a second. But of course, we're going to do this anonymously. So
it's not actually anonymous, right? Because you're going to let them open their eyes.
It will be, yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, you will actually see who chooses what.
Yeah, okay.
Just you have to make the choice without being influenced by others. So choose between A and B. Does everybody have their what they want or what they think it should be?
The QR code, I should have said at the beginning. This is the same QR code at the beginning, at the bottom of these slides. If you use your phone, you can post a question anonymously, and
anonymously.
Danny Cosme will compile them, and we'll also have a lot of time for open Q&A at the end where you can just raise your hand. But I know sometimes people feel shy, and sometimes you think of something like, while it's up on the screen. So feel free to post questions using that QR code. But back to Alyssa, this or that.
Yeah, so you guys have all made your choice. So go ahead and shut your eyes. All right, raise your hand if you chose choice A, the one on your left. Okay, now keep your hands up if you chose choice A. We're going to have everybody else open their eyes. All right, so if your hand is down, you obviously chose choice B. If you chose choice B, why did you choose it? Somebody, go ahead.
I would say if you're thinking about your customers down the road, it gives the publication more opportunity to crop it in a way that would fit into their publication.
And just a reminder, when we're calling on folks, please identify yourself and your...
Good answer. Who chose choice A? Why did you choose choice A?
I'm Dan Rodmacher with Appalachian Voices. I wrestled with it, actually, but to me, seeing more of her face and the expression on her face was more powerful.
Very fair point. Anyone else who chose choice A? Do you want to add? So we wrestled with this too. I ended up choosing choice B, or I should say we. We collectively decided, the photographer Brent Anderson and I decided choice B was that kind of that moment that wasn't going to happen again. It was just a fleeting moment where she was emotional, and that was the reaction that she made, and I felt like my eye just really went to her and then went to the background and told the full story. Again, though, photojournalism is completely subjective. I find myself doing an edit, going to bed, waking up, and thinking, who chose that? Like, what was I thinking? So I go back and forth myself often. And here's another one. The last one were kind of very similar frames. These, as you can see, convey similar things, but are different, right?
Can you tell us the story?
Yeah, so this is in Kazakhstan in the Aral Sea, which is, as we know, used to be one of the largest lakes, actually, in the world, and now it is very much a shell of itself, and people who used to rely on it are struggling to survive around it. And this was an entire neighborhood that was just engulfed in sand near where the sea actually was. So now I'll take a moment to make your choices here. Everybody's got their choice. All right, go ahead and shut your eyes. And we'll keep it consistent. Raise your hand if you chose choice A. Wow. All right, open your eyes. Keep your hands up. All right. Why don't we, someone over here, who chose, go ahead, you chose choice A?
Yeah, to me, I like that choice A is a tighter shot, and the shadow across the door is like more visually engaging. But beyond that, the structure in choice A with the curtain across the door feels more like a house somebody might have lived in, whereas choice B feels more like a storage shed. So it feels like choice A tells a more human story to it.
Yeah, that was a really good answer. Anyone chose choice B? Anybody? We'll go over here since we.
Well, I like the composition. I actually think choice A is the better photograph, but I didn't understand the place at all and the scale. Mm. And so I would like to understand, like, where in the world are we and what are we talking about? And choice B told me more of that story.
That's a good point. Kind of how the same, like a drone image, would come in and provide that context. And when you're only choosing between these two that are very similar, you kind of have to decide what's more important. Anyone else want to defend A or B real quick?
Sure. I just got to that in, you know, your news outlet, an art outlet, that's an artistic photo, that's a news photo.
Very good point. Yeah, so I chose choice A. This is actually one of my absolute favorite images. We did four stories from the Aral Sea, and if I could, I love beautiful disasters, and to me, this is a beautiful disaster. It just is, it's in somebody's home. I could imagine somebody living there and needing to make a decision about where to go with their life, and I love the blue door. I think it just adds an element. I always think, if that door wasn't blue, would I love it as much? I don't know. I think it just adds a beautiful contrast. No, I didn't. And I didn't for, I think, a good reason, because at this time, you have to choose between often similar images within that series anyway, right? And for me, if I'm choosing 15 or 20 images total, I want to say this story maybe had more about 22, 25. It was a large story. I still don't want similar images. They went to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan to tell the story, and so we had a ton of content. I mean, the edit from the photographer, his initial wide edit was about 600 images that he sent to me. That's a very large place to start for me. I typically start, even for four stories, smaller with the photographer. They usually make some more decisions first, so I had to make a lot of hard decisions that... No, we ran about 22, 25 images with the story.
So that would have an impact on your decision?
Yes.
As opposed to just one?
Yeah. Absolutely. It totally does. And if there was another similar image, I would probably group it with these and have that same kind of conversation, is what point are we trying to tell with this image, and do we tell it with another image similar? Definitely still the one on the left.
I'm super interested in this comment. Can you tell us your name and where you're from again?
Oh, I'm sorry, Andy Fisher with Pew.
Thank you. Andy Fisher from Pew says, this is an art photo and this is a journalism photo. I'm super interested to hear what you mean by that, because that, from somebody who's not a journalist, would not be an obvious distinction.
I used to be a journalist, so I've done a lot of photo editing. But
I meant me, not you.
Photographs will fall in love with the artistic photograph, but as a consumer of news, you need to tell the news story.
So Alyssa, can you respond to that? Like in terms of what's the value of the art and falling in love with a beautiful image that, you know, it sounds like you and Andy have slightly different approaches, at least to this or that.
Yeah, to me, I think that they're both newsworthy. I think that one is definitely a little bit more beautiful to me, the one on the left. But I also think that it's about the context that you provide. And we definitely had other images that, of course, provided people who were struggling. And I think that, for me, combined with this, told the full news story. I'll also say this is one of our most beautiful photographers, Ebrahim Nuruzi. He just won a World Press for his work in Afghanistan. He is an artist, and he would probably call himself that as well. And so I think for him, he tries to see the beauty even in disasters. And I think that's how I approach photojournalism too, and perhaps maybe not necessarily the choice everyone would choose, but the choice that still tells the story in a way that makes you look and think differently.
I have a quick question on this, actually.
Yeah.
How much of your decision-making when you select a photo involves the photojournalist itself? Like, do they come with you with their preference of photograph and say, I'm really partial to image A versus image B?
Yeah, it's a great question. For me, I try to incorporate them as much as possible. I always give them, you know, I'm not necessarily looking through their raw take of every single frame they shot, because often that involves, you know, the occasional fee or something they didn't take. You know, they'll cull it to their favorites to start. And an enterprise story, something that's not breaking news, that's when I really try to get their input, and we collaborate. We'll get on calls for hours and go back and forth like this between images and really get to a point where they're proud of the work that they did. In a breaking news situation, often we just don't have that luxury. They're in the field. I'm filing off of their content, and I have to be confident in the decisions I make. Sometimes photographers will come back and say, did you not like this frame? It's easy to miss it, especially when there's hundreds coming in at once.
Just for clarification, do you see everything that they shoot? Does it feed you immediately, or do they edit it first for what you see?
So if they're in the field shooting, this is kind of the same if they're covering breaking news or if they're covering sports. They're making that decision on the ground. They can even crop in camera, but they typically don't have that time. So they're often just kind of looking through the back. They're saying, okay, I like this one. They'll tag it. And then they'll push a button that will send over Wi-Fi to me.
You're not seeing their entire.
Correct. Yeah. Typically, it's more just for time, because especially with these cameras nowadays, they're taking so many frames per second that if they sent me everything, it would just take too long to get to me. So they do the initial kind of. But typically what they do is they send a series. So if it's, you know, a drone, they would probably send six similar images. Exactly. So they're culling that probably from 30, but they're making some selects initially. All right. We have, I think, one more. Oh, I lied. There might be two. But all right. So this is a story about a river, actually, in the Amazon. And I promise you we have other images that show really the beauty of this river. And they're basically the first river to get personhood is actually what they called it, protection of the river in the Amazon. And so this was a community that lived and used the river. So I'll give you guys a second to make your choice here. All right, go ahead and shut your eyes and raise your hand if you chose choice A. All right, keep your hands raised and open your eyes. I'm kind of interested on this one, because this is one of those for me that I just immediately knew which one I wanted. I sometimes go back and forth, and I never wavered on this one. So I'm interested. If you chose choice A, how come?
I think it shows an element of hopefulness and personhood and like vibrancy. I think B plays into a lot of like Western stereotypes and indigenous communities. Like, number one seems like powerfully positive, I guess.
Positively powerful. Yeah, go ahead.
That strikes me as incredibly relatable. Like, that's something I know I do. All my friends
That's a good point.
And I have been failing as moderator. Can you also introduce yourself? Thanks.
Who chose choice B? Go ahead.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Kirsten Leiter from University of Pennsylvania School of Communication. I chose choice B because this child looks fierce, and they look like they were just bathing in the river. And so it captures like the daily life usage of the river, like the integration of life. And I think the fierceness represents like the sort of like powerful movement behind this like effort to get personhood for natural land and resources.
Yeah. Anyone else who chose choice B?
Go ahead.
Yeah, that might be true. This was by Andre Penner, and he is based in Brazil. So he's not based in the Amazon. He's based in Sao Paulo, but he spent a lot of time in the Amazon. And so I chose choice B. For me, the eyes, the cleanness of the background, the fierceness, I couldn't stop looking at this child. I thought his body language just really said, I've rolled out of the river and I'm freezing. I think we have one more here. I don't want to say too much about the story, but it is the same coral reef story from Tahiti. This was the photographer went spearfishing with actually an Olympic surfer's brother, who is also a professional surfer. This is Nike Vast, Kali Vast's younger brother, if you're into surfing. He'll be competing for Paris. So make your choice here. Everybody shut your eyes. Raise your hand if you chose choice A. All right, keep your hands up and open your eyes. All right, why did somebody choose choice A? How about someone who chose choice B? Go ahead.
I like choice B because it invites me to reflect on the whole ecosystem. Like, the subject is taking a pause. I have a lot of questions immediately. Why stopping? What's going on about the surface? Just like the stillness really gets me to think.
So when I first started working with the photographer, Daniel Cole, he chose the one on the right. And I said, I feel like I've seen this before. He was like, what do you mean? I said, I've done a lot of coral reef stories. Feel like there's every time there's this moment where the person looks up towards the water that they're going to. There's beautiful light. I've seen it before. For me, the one on the left, choice A, really shows the story of the Tahiti. It's the reef versus the wave. And if you impact the reef, you impact the wave. And I felt like that was kind of around him, sandwiched in the middle. And I liked the powerfulness of the spearfishing kind of out there as well. I thought it just filled the frame really nicely. But, sometimes a photographer comes in with what they want. And I always try to hear that out and then sometimes convince them of what I actually want. So we went with choice A. It's a good question. I can't honestly in the last couple of years think of a time that I have been. I would say in other situations where I work, I've covered Olympics and things like that where there's a little bit more oversight over my shoulder. And yeah, I have definitely been overruled in those cases. In a case like this, it's usually the photographer and I, and then it goes to the wire and there's not much. I'm the final say. I'm the one who sends these out to the world myself, so there's not another person who comes in after, in this situation at least, luckily.
Yeah. Thanks, Alyssa. So Alyssa has talked, you know, we've been talking a lot over the past few weeks leading up to this panel, and I think you have been, like, extremely heart-led in the work that you're doing. Like, it seems like you've said a lot of things, like, that you can just, like, feel it or you know when you see an image, right? And it's, like, a really incredible skill and talent to be able to do that really on the fly. I'm going to introduce kind of another variable in the equation here, which is Ali Sinclair is a behavior change expert and scientist here at Penn. And the work that we do here is often focused on how do we motivate people to take action in different kinds of ways. And so I'm going to ask Ali to talk a little bit about your work in terms of what actually motivates people to change their mind, to change their behavior, which may or may not be exactly the same goal, but what are some of the principles?
Thanks, Emily. Yeah, so first I want to start with the idea of how can we get people to engage with a story? How do we get people to read it, to share it, to keep thinking about it afterwards? And in the work that we've done together, as well as other studies that have come from your lab over the years, what we've repeatedly found is that when people feel that information matters to them and matters to people they know, they're much more willing to read it and share it. And that means that when we can find ways to make a story feel self-relevant or socially relevant, we can increase engagement. So for journalists, that might mean connecting a story to the impact for a local community, if you know that that community is going to be reading your work. Or it could be contextualizing climate change with relatable everyday examples that people can think about. I love the example that somebody shared earlier when looking at the image of the girl with a hair tie, saying that feels so relatable. Like, despite this community being on the other side of the planet, that's something that I do every day. Maybe you have a hair tie on your wrist right now. I really liked that idea of that's one way that you could highlight self-relevance in a story that might otherwise be quite remote from the day-to-day life that your readers might experience.
Yeah, you also have a lot of expertise in terms of learning and memory, and you were saying, like, what makes people hold on to something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the good news is that self-relevance will also make information more memorable, so you can kind of get a two-for-one deal there. And the reason is that whenever some new information relates to what we already know, like about ourselves or about the world, that kind of acts like a scaffold. So we can insert that new information into our prior knowledge structure, and that makes it stick more in memory. There are other ways that we can make things more memorable, too. Like, for example, surprise can make things memorable. So there's kind of two ends of a spectrum and a sweet spot in the middle. So at one end, if something is super familiar to us, it's like kind of too close to our prior knowledge. And so it might be really easy to accept and process readily, but it doesn't really stand out in memory. It kind of blurs together with everything similar that we've seen before. Kind of like when Alyssa was saying that that one image of the diver looking up towards the surface might be beautiful, but if that's like many other images that you've seen before, you're not going to remember that specific image and how it related to that specific story. On the far other extreme of that spectrum, we've got things that are so surprising, like if a clown entered this room right now, where it's like totally out of left field. And in the moment, that might capture your attention, but you actually might be less likely to remember it later on.
Like, that's why I didn't schedule a clown.
And that's why you didn't schedule a clown, right? Like, imagine if 2 years from now, someone was like, hey, were you at SEJ in 2024? You're going to index your memories by thinking first about the category of, like, okay, conferences, SEJs. I've been to many SEJ conferences before. And a clown is not going to be a part of that sort of script, that sort of template that you look for in your mind. And so you're actually less likely to remember this super surprising thing. But in the middle, between those two extremes, there's a sweet spot. When something is minimally counterintuitive or when it's a little bit surprising, that is extra memorable. So when it mostly aligns with what we predicted, but there's something about it that's a twist, that's unexpected, new and surprising information, that is really likely to stick in memory, especially as sort of this unique experience that we retain and remember the details of it. And we can also think about how emotion increases what we remember. And here, it's again interesting to think about both positive and negative emotion. Both of those extremes can enhance memory, but it can also change how we remember and what details we remember. So negative information we often think of as being really memorable, but it can also create a kind of tunnel vision. So it's like narrowing the scope of attention, and that constrains what we actually remember. So, for example, if you read a really negative news story with a really striking, scary image, that image might stick in your mind, and you might hyperfixate on those really frightening details. But because of the way it changes what's happening in your brain, it can actually impair memory for other related details of that context. So, for example, maybe you no longer remember the venue, the source from which you obtained the story. Later on, that image is still in your head, and you're like, but where was this about again? Or where did I read this? How could I find that article again? And that might not actually be serving your goals if you want people to remember your story from your outlet and then share that with others later on, or if you want them to be able to go and tell the story again to somebody that they know. In contrast, positive emotions can sometimes be harder to evoke, but it can lead to stronger memory that's more expansive, kind of including all of these associated details.
And Allie, when you say positive images, like when we're talking about really hard things, like, do you want to clarify a little bit what you mean? Like, because I think we don't want to be too Pollyanna-ish, right? Like, we don't want to be unrealistic. So say more about, like, what kind of positive feelings might we have about something that's so hard to grapple with?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm using positive and negative as a kind of blanket term here, but I think that does not mean that we have to tell a crisis story in a way that is misleading or falsely optimistic. I think we can inspire positive emotions like determination or hope. And through things like solutions-focused journalism, we don't have to be saying that there is no problem. We can just focus more on what people are doing about it. And what the actions are that they're taking. That can, so one dichotomy that we talk about in emotion and motivation research is the distinction between approach and avoidance. So approach emotions are things that make us want to engage with something, want to go towards something. And those can be things we traditionally think of as positive emotions like hope, happiness, or determination, but also some negative things like anger that leads us to want to confront something and take action. Conversely, avoid emotions are things that make us want to withdraw and avoid something entirely, like disgust or sadness or fear. It makes us want to pull away. And so focusing on those approach motivation strategies can lead people to engage with your work, and that doesn't have to mean that you put a falsely positive spin on it if it is, in fact, something that is important and upsetting. Like, you can still find ways to emphasize action and get people to engage with it.
Can you show us some examples?
Yeah. So we actually just recently ran a study where we looked at how we can change the way that we frame a message and how we choose images to try to increase these emotions that drive people to engage.
I'm going to just tell the behind the scenes thing, which is this is specifically for you all.
Just for you.
When we were having conversations with Alyssa and we were trying to think about like the work that Allie's leading and trying to think about like what kinds of decision making lead to impact. This was really inspired by Alyssa kind of talking a little bit about the kinds of choices that she's making and then this or that game. And we were like, oh, well, we could think about some of these different kinds of things that Allie studies and collect some data on, you know, a few hundred people and see what we find.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to highlight that the articles that we used in this experiment were provided by Alyssa and Max. So we're actually doing some psychological research with their actual articles in their photos. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. Okay, so first, let's return to this idea of how we choose which image we want to highlight in a story. And I know Alyssa just unpacked how she makes these decisions with that great this or that game. But in that case, we were choosing between two very similar images. Like, if you can only go with one, what do you choose? But there are other choices that we can make among, like, totally different categories of images. If the content is really different, how do you choose which one to foreground? Or say you have many images that are all definitely going to be a part of an article, but you need to choose one that's going to be next to the headline. How do you choose that top line image? So how can we select images that increase engagement? And I'm going to show an example here from a story from the AP that Alyssa provided. It was called Climate Migration, Alaska Village Resists Despite Threats. And here are four different images which were all included in that article. But say you are looking through this set and you want to choose one of them to feature right up they're like at the top next to the headline. This is a pretty difficult choice, right? You've got some shots of the environment, some shots of people, some that are taken close up, highlighting a central detail, and some that are taken from further away, like this drone imagery. And we can also think about how to craft our message. How do we get people to want to read an article? And there are different ways that we could frame the same story. So, for example, here's that original headline again. Maybe we want to drum up those negative or avoid emotions. Maybe we want to emphasize crisis and urgency. To do this, we might tweak the wording to say something like, climate change threatens to destroy Alaska Village. Or conversely, maybe we want to highlight action instead, emphasizing what people are doing about it. And you can see from the original headline, that was part of that story too. So maybe we instead want to say, Alaska villagers adapt to climate change threats. And note here that we're not saying that this is a rosy picture. We're still emphasizing that there are threats of climate change, but we're focusing more on what people are doing about it. So how do we choose among these messages and these images? How can we select framings that motivate people to read and share stories? Just a few weeks ago, we did an experiment with 300 people to answer this question. So the first thing we did was take a set of articles provided by Alyssa and Max, and we tweaked the headlines and lead sentences to emphasize either action or crisis, as I just described. So here's another example with a Hurricane Idalia story from Max. Here's the crisis framing version where we really amp up the death and destruction angle. Or an action framing where we highlight how rescue crews are taking action in the aftermath of this disaster. And I want to note here that if you look at those lead sentences that fall under the crisis or action framing, we're not making stuff up. We're not the journalists. We're not going to put words in your mouth. We are taking real sentences from these original articles. So it's really a choice of, like, if you are already working with the same story, how can you choose one piece of information over a different piece of information to highlight at the very top, such as what would be shared on social media, to try to get people to read an article? And second, we looked at the different images that we could select. So here are some images from Max's story. On the left, you see a wide-angle, like, drone shot of the environment taken from far away. Versus on the right, you see a close-up shot of this devastation in the environment. Conversely, we can also look at images that feature people. So on the left bottom here, we see a shot of people taken from far away, whereas on the right, we see a shot of people close up. So we're going to be looking at these two variables, environment versus people, and whether it's a near shot or a far shot. Okay, so putting it all together, on a given trial, a participant in our study might see something like this, kind of like an article preview that you might see on social media. They see an image, the headline, and the lead. And so for each article in our set, we created 8 alternate versions of it by crossing every possible image with the 2 different message framings. And participants see for each article out of a set of 11, they see just one possible version of that article. And they don't know that we're doing all of this manipulation with the alternate articles behind the scenes. So for each article, we have them rate how much they want to read it, how much they would be willing to share that article, either directly with somebody they know or broadly on social media. They rate the positive emotions they feel, like determination and hope, and the negative emotions like fear and hopelessness. So what did we find? First, I'm going to spoiler you by putting it up front, but we saw that the framing of the message influences emotion. So we can evoke positive or negative emotions by highlighting action or crisis in our headlines. I'm going to show you some data here just to walk you through this plot to orient you. On the x-axis, we'll be looking at the 3 different message framings. So the original version of the article is in the middle, and we're going to compare emotion ratings for the original article versus our action-focused version and our crisis-focused version on the right. And on the y-axis, we're going to look at the strength of the positive emotions that people feel. So what we found here is a really nice clean effect where you can see the original version is in the middle. When we highlight action, we increase positive emotions. And when we highlight crisis, we decrease positive emotions. Now let's look at the exact same thing, but for negative emotions. And here we see the exact opposite effect. So relative to the original version of an article, action framing decreases negative emotions, and crisis framing increases negative emotions. So this is just showing that it worked. By choosing to foreground different pieces of information from the same story, we can change considerably how people feel just when they look at that headline. Okay, but does emotion actually matter? Because we don't just care about how they feel, we care about what they do about it. But luckily, we do find that emotion influences engagement. So here I'm going to plot two separate lines on these plots, one line for negative emotions and one line for positive emotions.
Before you show, do you want to have people guess what's going to happen?
Yeah, okay. So first we're going to look at intentions to read an article. Hands up if you think that negative emotions will motivate reading. Okay, hands up if you think that positive emotions will motivate reading. Hands up if you think that both of them will motivate reading. Hands up if you think that neither of them will motivate reading. One person back there, brave soul. All right. If you answered both, you are correct. So what we see here is the strength of the emotion, either positive or negative, and we're looking at how it predicts intentions to read an article. And we see that the stronger the emotional response, regardless of whether those emotions are positive or negative, that is just as equally driving desire to read. And next, if we look at intentions to share an article with others, surprise, surprise, we see the exact same effect. So again, both positive and negative emotions are motivating engagement. And I want to highlight that this is exciting because oftentimes in journalism, you hear the idea, like, if it bleeds, it leads. We want to emphasize these negative emotions. But we also know that that can lead to a sense of despair. That might not motivate action. And what we're showing here is that there is another way. By evoking positive emotion, and that doesn't have to be false hope. That can also be determination. That can lead people to want to engage. So it doesn't have to be a trade-off between focusing on solutions versus driving engagement. I think that's a great point, and we were really careful to avoid doing that in this experiment by only using words that were actually present in the original article. So we're not changing the content of the story. These are published stories. We are selecting different sentences that were actually there in the story. And even when these are quite negative, for example, the hurricane devastation, there is a grain of hope or something about what are people doing to address the problem. Even if that solution isn't done yet, even if people are suffering right now, you can show that there is a problem while focusing more on how people are taking action to address that. And that's also why we chose to call it action framing rather than hope framing.
Yes. And anger can also be an approach emotion, like you said.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for raising that point. First, I want to say, just to answer your direct question, how did we measure this? As I mentioned before, we're just looking at intentions here, so it's essentially a rating scale. But I do want to note that we have validated that this does, in other studies, map onto real-world behavior of how people read and share information. So, for example, in other studies from Emily's lab where they've used this exact kind of rating scale, looking at emotion, looking at self-relevance and social relevance, we can show that in the lab, how people rate this predicts population level sharing. So if you look at which articles go viral, we can predict which articles will be widely read and shared just based on the subjective responses of a smaller group of participants who make these kinds of ratings in a laboratory setting. And second, to your other point, I agree that disaster coverage can be more engaging, and we know that this kind of thing is more exciting than, say, a story about, you know, a dog show or something like that. But we're looking at changes within the same article. So within an article that's about a hurricane disaster, how can we change how we foreground that information? Like, it's still about a hurricane. We're not shying away from that. We're still showing an image of the devastation or, you know, what is happening. We're not changing which sort of topics are more newsworthy than others. We're saying within a particular topic with the same story, we could choose to frame it in different ways. And the final point that I want to make in response to what you said is that negative emotions are generally easier to evoke in terms of the strength. So it is easier to get really strong negative emotions than really strong positive emotions. However, what we're showing is that if you can elicit stronger positive emotions, it actually has the same effect as negative emotions. But that doesn't mean that it's just as easy to get to that sort of strength level if you're going the positive route. So there might need to be other strategies that you use to try to increase emotion, such as which images you select, which I can get to in a moment, actually.
I'm gonna actually ask Ali to focus on the visuals a little bit just to scope this panel, because we're really interested in the visual storytelling element here, but it would be awesome to get to talk with you after this panel. Thank you so much.
And to your point, yes, there are other studies showing that metaphors increase engagement and also change how phrases are processed in the brain, but that's beyond the scope of the study, I'm afraid. Thank you. All right, so moving on to...
One more over there?
Yeah. No, please go ahead.
Go ahead and introduce yourself, too.
Yeah. Dina Capriello, Chief Communications Officer for RMI, Recognize Institute. Two questions, and I'm sorry if I missed this. These 300 people, was it a general pop audience? Who was the audience?
Thank you, yeah.
And secondly, did you go a step further into segmentation of the audience to see if these different headlines had different reactions? And then, sorry, one more. I'm a former journalist, I know how to compound questions.
Fantastic. Yeah, I will do my best to answer all three. If I fail to, please just prompt me about the one I missed, because it's hard to keep three things in mind at once.
Were you paid to ask those questions? Because it tees up exactly, I think, what Ali wants
to
tell you
about.
Yeah, great
job. Yeah, let's pretend you're a plant in the audience here. No, don't worry. It's great. I really appreciate it. So first, yes, thank you for prompting me to talk a little bit about the people who were participating in this study. I didn't cover those details for the sake of time. Basically, these are all American adults across the lifespan. We didn't restrict age here. This is an online sample of people who volunteer to participate in psychological studies for some amount of monetary compensation. So this is not like a probability sampling approach with a nationally representative poll. However, the demographic makeup of the users on this platform are roughly comparable to the makeup of the United States, so it's not a particularly skewed sample. A lot of psychological research is often conducted with undergraduates. That's not what we're looking at here. So it's not perfectly representative of the United States, but it's a decent proxy. The other question was about whether we've done segmentation. We have not looked at that yet with these data. We actually collected these about 2 weeks ago, but that's something that we're interested in following up on, and we are certainly able to do that. We have detailed demographic information about these participants, including, you know, age, race, location, socioeconomic status, education level, sexuality, more, yeah. And then your final question was about how do we take this a step further? How do we get people to take action? And that's something we're very much interested in. A lot of my work focuses on behavior change, so how do we actually get people to do something about it? And I will not go into detail about it right now because we're going to talk more about it in a little bit with another study.
I'm
going to
suggest actually maybe we should, because then we'll have time for some of the broader engagement. We're hoping for folks who joined us a little bit after the beginning, we're going to take some audience questions pretty soon, and then we're also thinking about some breakout groups to be a little bit more interactive with everybody on the panel. So, Ali, I'm going to suggest that you go ahead and tell us about the photo framing, but then also this excellent audience question about impact.
Great. I mean, the tournament slides are right after.
Yeah, great. Go for it.
Okay, I'll just go right into it. For now, I'll just briefly say that we very much care about motivating action. And we know from the motivation and decision-making literature that both positive and negative emotion can motivate action, but positive emotion is oftentimes a more motivating factor, especially in terms of long-term sustained effort towards a goal, which is something that the climate crisis requires. If you want to motivate people to do something immediately, negative emotion can be a really powerful lever for that, but not so good for sort of sustained effort and future planning. But with that, let's turn to our final results. You're going to have to trust me here because I'm not showing you the plots, though I'm happy to share them later. But I'm just going to give you the take-home points here. But we looked at the effects of these different image types that we can include and how they might interact with the way that we frame a message. And in brief, what we found is that when we include an image of a person, regardless of whether it's a close-up shot or a far-away shot, that increases emotional responses, both positive and negative. And we've seen already that those emotions are driving engagement. So this aligns very much with the wisdom that we've heard from Alyssa and Max, as well as others in the crowd here, that having eyes in the image, having these people, really increases this emotional response to an image. And finally, what we actually found was that the combination of an image of a person with this action framing led to the strongest emotions of all. That was the most potent combination in the study. So in this example of the hurricane story, by showing an image of the people who are taking action to address this crisis, and again, we still see the devastation in the background, we see the floodwaters, we're not shying away from the fact that this is an environmental disaster, but by focusing on how people are taking action to address a problem, that was evoking the strongest emotional response. With that, I'm actually going to go right into the next thing. First, to sum up, evoking positive or negative emotions increases engagement. And we see that by combining images of people with action framing, that maximizes emotion. And pause for one sec because I see some people trying to take pictures. In a moment, people are taking pictures of this one, but then I will go back. Absolutely. Thank you for teeing that up, because we're going to get into that in the next study that I'm going to share. But I'll also mention that we have been talking about running a follow-up study to this one, where it's still directly tied to news articles, but we want to give people a small endowment of money and then let them allocate donations to these different causes, so we can see how this kind of framing influences intentions to donate to support a cause. So that would be more directly linked to the study as well. But I'll also talk about intentions to donate to climate causes briefly in the next study as well.
Yeah, before you move on, Alyssa and Max, is there anything that you want to reflect on here, or any questions that you have for Ali, or things that before we move to the kind of next phase of action?
I think crucially what this does is it gives me pause, right? I mean, at the local level, right, there's a lot of pressure to get information out and to get it out very quickly, whether you're in the face of competition or you're in a natural disaster where information is moving very fast. What this does, though, is gives me a very necessary pause, right? Because what the actions that we take as reporters and the way we frame things, particularly in a very instable situation like a hurricane, that has power and that has real possibility to influence people. And so I think what this does is show that as reporters, we need to step back, even in a moment of very fast-breaking news, and take a deep breath and think really deeply about how we want to frame the message. So I think that exemplifies that a lot.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for us on the climate team at AP, we are constantly harping on who is the story. Not necessarily what, but who is going to tell us that story? Who are we going to step into their life to carry the story? And seeing that person, you know, that beautiful door that we showed earlier, that didn't lead the story, right? We want to lead with the people who are impacted and see the people, because climate change is caused by people. It also harms people. And also it's how you relate to stories, right? I don't come from a science background, so when people start talking about 1.5, my eyes kind of glaze over. But if I see somebody who is, you know, standing in their destroyed home, then I start to understand and care. So we really try to focus on that. And then another thing that, real quick, that you kind of brought up that I thought was so interesting is you asked earlier about, you know, does anybody kind of oversee necessarily or tell me, you know, don't show that image. And we had an interesting debate on a story on a paracu, which is a giant, giant big fish from the Amazon. I just saw a picture of this big fish and I said, okay, we're doing a story on it because it's just incredible. And the story was about sustainability and about how this community actually uses every part of this big fish. And it's even, you know, people wear it, like the skin, and buy expensive purses on it, every single part of this fish. And it's only a certain amount can be fished every season. But in order to catch this very, very large fish, it takes multiple people. And to kill it, they club it over the head with like a massive club. And to me, that was a crucial part of the story, because you cannot have the fish without killing the fish. And my boss and the video producer were mortified by this. They were like, no, we will not show this. I went full into it, and I said, no, we have to. It's part of the journey of the fish. But I took their concerns into consideration, and so when you look at the story, it is not the first image. It's not very large. It is smaller within the story. But I still really like the photo and the clubbing of the fish.
And I think that's a great point that you bring up, too, that many of these stories have multiple images. You can supplement the story that you're telling with multiple choices that highlight different aspects of a story. And what we focused on here was like, what should you choose as like the first one that people see? But there's absolutely a lot more storytelling that happens along the way with the additional images that they encounter. And I think all of those are really important.
Absolutely.
I love that you kept that part of the story. Yeah. Thank you, Alyssa.
Moving on, if you'll bear with me for a little bit more data, this one's shorter. I'm going to share some results from some work that we've recently done that we're calling an intervention tournament. Broadly speaking, the goal here is to motivate people to take action against climate change. But to do this, we want to test a variety of different strategies that we think might work. And the goal here is to pit them against each other. We have the same common outcome measures, and we're going to use that as a kind of common currency to compare all of these strategies and see which one works best. And we can also use segmentation approaches to figure out for whom each strategy works best. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the studies that we've run with this intervention tournament, and then do a bit of an interactive game where I'm going to have you do a voting thing to try to guess what you think the impact of each intervention will be, and then I'll tell you which ones worked best. Okay, so as I said, our goal here is to motivate people to take action to address climate change, and in these studies, we're looking at action intentions in two ways. We think about individual actions that people could take, such as driving less, flying less, eating less meat or paying for green energy at home, as well as others. But we also think about collective actions, like intentions to donate, volunteer for organizations that address climate change, start or sign petitions, contact your representatives, and so on and so forth. So both of these arms are of interest to us, and of course, climate crisis requires institutional action as well. What we're focusing on here is sort of the psychological mechanisms that we can use to get individuals to care about taking action, both themselves in terms of how they can connect with others to engage in collective action. So how might we do this? We have tested six different broad intervention approaches. Within each of those six, there are several sort of sub-variations of each one as well, and I'm not going to get into the details of that for the sake of time today, but I'll describe each of these six general approaches overall and then have you vote. So we can organize these six interventions into three different themes. The first theme we'll call self-relevance and social relevance, which I've already talked a little bit about today. The second theme we can think of as future thinking, and the third is what I'll call action impact. So just to unpack each of these interventions under each theme, first under self and social relevance, we have an intervention first where we ask people to look at some news headlines about climate change and write a comment as if they were going to share that article on social media, where we prompt them to reflect on why that news article matters to them or matters to people they know. So we're trying to increase that perceived self-relevance and social relevance by prompting people to take a moment to really think about and make that connection and actually write it down. Next, we have the social norm information intervention. Here, people do an interactive quiz game where they learn about what other Americans think about climate change. For example, what percent of Americans would support an energy transition, or what percent are climate deniers. So they try to guess the statistic, and then we give them feedback that's based on data from recent national polls. Under the future thinking theme, we have an action planning intervention, where participants are asked to select one goal, either collective or individual action, from a list of some suggested goals that we give them, things that we know are a relatively higher impact. So they choose one goal, and then we guide them to make a really detailed plan about how they would achieve that goal. That involves identifying all of the steps that would be involved, really imagining and thinking through what it would look like to engage in that process. They identify a possible obstacle that could arise and come up with an idea for how they would overcome that obstacle. And they also imagine what the outcomes of that action could be for themselves, for their community, and for the environment. Next, we have the guided imagination intervention. Here, we walk participants through a guided imagination exercise where they try to visualize, using all of their senses, a possible future scenario where they imagine a city that is either green and thriving if we do take action to address climate change, or a negative future, a city plagued by heat waves and pollution if we fail to take sufficient action. Finally, under the action impact theme, we have the action impact information intervention. This is another quiz-style game where people try to guess the impact of various actions that individuals could take to address climate change. So, for example, if you skipped one transatlantic flight, how much would that reduce emissions versus eating a vegan diet, and so on and so forth. And then they get feedback about those estimates, and those mitigation reduction estimates are coming from a recent meta-analysis from the climate science side. Finally, we have the carbon footprint intervention. And yes, we know that this was the product of BP, but it's important, we think, to test this because it's still a pretty common approach for trying to motivate people to engage in these individual actions. For example, the EPA has a very elaborate tool for estimating carbon footprints and looking at how it could reduce your impact, and that's still widely promoted. So in this intervention, it's basically what you would expect. People fill out a survey about their current lifestyle and then get some personalized feedback about their carbon footprint and how various actions that they could take would reduce their carbon footprint. Any questions about this sort of broad-level intervention strategies before we start voting? All right. Wonderful. So next, I'm going to have you get out your phones and scan this QR code. And I also want to note that if you already did this voting game at the ASC, the Annenberg School for Communication table that was in the lobby during a reception a few days ago. Please don't do it again. So if you've already heard me give this spiel, we've already got your data. But for the rest of you, we're going to mine your brains right now and get you to make some predictions. So when you scan this, you're going to first see an overview of the interventions I just described. You can just scroll past that, but it is there if you need a reminder. And then you're going to see a sliding scale under each of these intervention labels. And that sliding scale goes from negative 10 to positive 10. A score of 0 would mean that you think an intervention doesn't do anything. Negative values would mean you think it backfires, like it decreases motivation to take action. Whereas positive values would mean you think it works, so it motivates people to take action to address climate change. So if you can just submit your predictions, try to drag the slider negative to positive to try to guess how strong each intervention would work.
Again, it's general.
Yeah, sorry. This is United States adults. Yes, general population.
There was a question through the main question QR code about whether folks will share slides afterwards. If you want to email us, we're happy to send you the stuff from today's presentations.
Yeah, and I'll also note that all of these findings are really recent and they're unpublished currently, so we're happy to share them with you, but we ask that you don't share them widely quite yet. But also, if you reach out to us, we are happy to add you to our email list so you can get updates on when we've written up the full results from all of these studies. Yeah. All right. General sense, I think most people have submitted their ratings. Does anyone want to go ahead and put their hand up and tell us which one they thought would be most effective and why? Yes, over there. Great. Thank you. Anyone else predict a different winner? Yeah.
The last one was action planning.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say I'm Garrett Broad, I'm a professor at Rowan. I would say my guess would be that one because sort of the psychology of pledging to things, mm-hmm. and so that might lead to follow through.
Great. McKenna, up front.
Oh, I was going to say similarly. So I'm McKenna, University of Washington, and clinical psychologist. So I think a lot about SMART goals and very specific.
Anyone else want to share a prediction? All right. You guys are spot on, but also some of you have an advantage of psychology knowledge. So what I'm going to show you here is the effect on intentions to engage in climate action. For the sake of time, I'm collapsing across all of the actions today, so that's including the individual things like driving less and flying less and the collective things like donating and volunteering. We can also look at this separately, and we have, but I'm not going to go through all of those plots separately. Okay, so on the left here, we're looking at those six interventions that I just described to you. And at the very top, we have a control group where they didn't do any intervention at all. So that's our baseline. And statistically, I'm going to be comparing each of these interventions to the control group to see if it was more effective. And here, we'll look at the strength of their intention. So values to the right indicate that it was more effective. So first, if we look at our control group, I'm just going to be drawing a dotted line where the mean of the control group is. So anything that is to the right of that dotted line means it was more effective than the control group. So what did we find? We found that 3 out of 6 interventions were significantly better than the control group when you're looking across all of these actions separately. And specifically, the news comments, action planning, and imagination conditions were all effective. But tied for first place are the action planning and guided imagination interventions. So to sum up here, we show that thinking about future actions or those future outcomes were the most effective ways to motivate climate action. And I'll also note that I didn't show this plot here right now, but we did also look at whether these interventions increased motivation to share news articles about climate change or petitions about climate change, and we found that that news comments intervention was the most effective for motivating sharing for both of those types of content.
Yeah, also going back to the point that someone had raised about donations, I think it's also important to say that the news comments, when we get people to think about why the stories are relevant to them and people they know, that not only did it make them want to share that story more, but it also made them want to share petitions to engage in that kind of collective action to get other people on board with these causes also.
Yeah.
So thanks for sharing all that, Allie. I think I would like to just come back a little bit now to the local level with.
No, sorry, I have not plotted on the fly what your voting results are yet.
If you reach out to us,
we're mining that because we want to know what your predictions are and compare that, so we can publicly embarrass you. No, of course it's all anonymous. But yeah, I'm afraid I don't have the results on the fly for you.
But if you reach out to us, we are happy to send you both the predictions of folks in this room as well as preprints of papers and the findings. So coming back to how we might actually kind of put some of these things into practice, we've heard from Max and Alyssa about some of the high-stakes decisions that they're making. And before we open it up finally for the broader discussion and Q&A, I just want to hear a little bit from Max about the kinds of challenges that you faced and how you've been navigating that as a local person on the ground.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the answer to the question evolves every year as local newsrooms evolve, whether it's hedge funds that are operating local newsrooms, nonprofits. There's a lot of different models with a lot of different answers in terms of viability of the success of a local newsroom. But particularly for the state of Florida, in terms of difficulties, I don't know if you've seen the news. There's a governor in Florida who, how do I say, is not particularly fond of reporters, and access has become a large issue for reporters, particularly in times of natural disaster or even news events. And so, getting access has become a large challenge in the state of Florida. Whether it's data access, like a good example is. You may have seen the news. There's a fish die-off in the Florida Keys right now, and the killer of this fish is still largely unknown. It's not a pathogen. It's not a bacteria. It's not a red tide toxin or salinity or ocean temperature. And so the state of Florida used to have a public database that was tracking every fish kill across the state of Florida, where it was located, what species was affected, images of the die-off. This was all publicly accessible data. As this new mysterious disease began to take, or whatever it is, not a disease, but this mysterious fish kill began to take hold, that data was pulled from the website. And a records request last week that I put in has been hit with a $3,000 check or a $3,000 invoice. So if I want to access the data, it's going to take $3,000 to get it. And this used to be public data, right? And so now, as the potential for perception and environmental crisis unfolds, access to data begins to shrink. So that's a problem at a local level that you have to. But the antidote to that is really getting to know people that are either researchers that are involved in on the ground science, right? Community leaders that are community voices, people that are representing a group of people, lower income communities particularly, finding community leaders that represent a population and building trust with them is an antidote to lack of access, particularly from governments. And, I think, too, community engagement is such a huge part of local reporting. Being able to, because these are the communities that we live and work in, and you know, we have a stake in our communities as well. And so being able to tell stories and build the trust of our neighbors and of the people that lead our cities is crucially important to our work. So it's a tough job, but I think, you know, in knowing all of this data, like I said earlier, too, like the intention behind what we do is really important. And it's harder every single day as the pressure increases to put out content, right? So we have to fill a newspaper 365 days a year. That's a lot of stuff you have to write and you have to photograph. And so taking pause, reflecting on this research and knowing that what we put out there has can invoke a certain emotional response, I think is a really important takeaway from today.
Yeah, thanks. And you're bringing up kind of the community engagement part of it and the local knowledge. And I know Alyssa has talked a lot about, even though the AP is operating at scale, how important it is to you to be working with folks locally. And so can you talk a little bit about how you do that? Like, if folks, for example, in the room wanted to work with you, like, what makes a good pitch, or how might they go about engaging with a bigger organization?
Yeah, we love collaborating with other news organizations. We think that, you know, sometimes it's a writer from a local news organization and we supply the visuals, but we like finding ways to partner and use the strengths that we all have, from editing to video to just how to present the story, right? And so that's things we've worked with. We just did a story with Indigenews in Canada. We're working on a couple right now. We did a training with the Press Trust of India in India, where we collaborated and did visual stories on the ground and showed them how you take local reporting and put it on the global scale, right? So someone experiencing something in Kochi, India, and how that is actually not just a problem there, right? It is a problem that people all over the world are experiencing, and providing that global context for every story that we do. But we're incredibly interested in partnering with news organizations to tell stories that we might not normally tell because we might not have someone in that location.
Great. And so what are you looking for? Like, when you go and you're like scrolling through people's Instagram feeds or looking for people who are talented and taking amazing images, like, what are some of the things you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking for pitches that visually tell something, that there's some sort of action that we can capture, but also for diverse stories that show a community that we haven't highlighted or take us somewhere that we haven't been. I think that's the best power of photojournalism, is I get to go all over the world without actually leaving my home. I do like to leave my home, but also at times there's some of these places I'm okay experiencing it through someone else's eyes, especially after a natural disaster. I think that it takes an incredible amount of talent to go and do that. So we're always looking for diverse stories by diverse people and diverse communities that can really show the power of climate impact.
Thanks, Alyssa. So I'm going to open it up for if folks have any burning questions on their mind. Go ahead. Fantastic. Thank you for that.
Yeah. First, I want to say I think all of those strategies that you described are great. That's along the lines of what we would recommend. I also want to note that in that study about news engagement with the headlines that I showed, I didn't mention this before, but we intentionally made half of our articles domestic and half international. And that was in part because of Alyssa's encouragement that we should really be thinking about how to get Americans to engage with these international stories. And that's something important to us as well.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Alyssa also wants to say anything about this question of how you think about, from your perspective as a photo editor, like the international piece for Americans with varied life experiences.
Yeah, I loved your examples. I mean, to me, that's the heart of what you have to do is say, here's the issue, and it might seem so far and foreign, but actually where you live, this has happened or could happen. I worked on the story when we were in Koji on the seawall, and so we tried to expand it to other places that have it or are building and places that there's been successful seawalls. And what that looks like and why it matters to where you live.
I'll also mention that some other people in our lab are interested in audio data and how people use language and communicate with others and things like that. So we would definitely be interested in chatting more. Please don't hesitate to reach out.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I agree with a lot of that. If you're familiar with it, there's some great survey research coming out of the programs on climate communication at Yale and at George Mason University, where they look at what they call the Six Americas, or how we can sort of characterize different attitudes that Americans hold towards climate change. And one of those categories at the far extreme is the dismissive category. These are the people who do not believe that climate change is happening, and they're really not the people that we're trying to reach with our interventions. We're focusing on the majority of Americans, who are those who are aware that climate change is happening and believe that that's the case, but they feel disengaged because it feels really far away to them. They can't visualize the outcomes and how it would personally impact them, or emotionally it feels so frightening that they are afraid to engage with it. They would rather not think about it at all because it is so painful to actually think about that reckoning that could be coming. So we're interested in reaching those people who do believe that climate change is happening, but they're not currently doing anything about it for one of those reasons. And so we hope that that can mobilize really actually the majority of Americans who are in those categories through these other strategies where it's like, let's stop, you know, sort of beating the dead horse about, is it happening? Here's the evidence over and over again, when a certain segment of the population might be really, really hard to convince. And there's a lot of people who don't need to be convinced of that, but do need to be told why they need to act and how they can act. And that's the focus of our work.
I just wanted to add, we focus a lot on solutions journalism. I didn't talk a lot about it here because, to be honest, it's not the most visually exciting always, but providing easy solutions that are, a lot of times people think if I change to this cleaner version, it's more expensive, and that's a burden on me. But providing real cheaper solutions, different heat pumps, geothermal, different things that people can do to their homes on a simple level when you're looking, we write a lot about that. And we're not talking about, you know, we're not rehashing necessarily why you have to do this, but providing just the solution for people that they might not be thinking about, I think is a way to move the conversation forward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some of the, like what Max talked about, some of the different homes that people are now building when they can in order to, we know hurricanes are going to hit this area again. What can you do? I mean, it's not totally hitting your point, but I think that people are starting to move the conversation towards that.
I do think, too, if you look at the local level, depending on the community, there are stories that will tell you, you know, this is how our downtown could look if we implement X natural solution or X adaptable engineering, right? Building a project that can adapt to 2 feet of sea level rise, 3 feet of sea level rise. I think at the local level, you'll see that. Using Idalia as a case study, though, I mean, that was an area that had a lot of natural infrastructure already built into the community because their culture almost revolves around high water, right? So they've adapted to high water. But in a very urban area like Tampa, with low-lying structures, it's a very vulnerable community. So to be able to compare the two with your own local community, I think, is as a local reporter, that's what we're striving to do very often, to say, see this community that has elevated a lot of their structures. We'll take a look at where we live and our risks. What can we learn from them? I think that's a big goal of local reporters.
Just to add to that, to your point, I think the future thinking strategies that we've tested in some of our work can also be really helpful for motivating this kind of preventative action. Because if you can help people imagine and understand what an outcome could look like before they have to experience it, that can be really valuable to then get them to think through what steps they need to take now to prevent that outcome from happening.
I'm going to suggest we take the two more questions from hands here and then switch to our slightly more intimate groups for the last half hour or so. I think we have a little less. Yep, we've got exactly half hour left in this session. Go ahead.
So Garrett Broad from Rowan. My question is about animals, non-human animals. And so obviously a lot of the biggest populations that are affected by climate change are non-human animal populations. I'm wondering whether through your practical work or through any of your psychological research, just the same kinds of strategies that you're talking about here, do you think they apply to, you know, making concern and action around taking action for animal groups?
I think that most people generally care about animals. You know, that's actually probably more of an easy way to get people in. We recently did a story. It was actually one of our writers just did a quick study about endangered animals. And I have to admit, one of the animals he listed, I thought, what is that? It was an abalone. I didn't know what an abalone was. I got way too into the abalone. And then we did a story about a town that has been, like, is a shell of itself because of the abalone population has just been overfished and the rising temperatures of the seas, and they are having a hard time surviving. And that town used to thrive on abalone fishing. And so I think taking the animal issue but relating it to the people who depended on it was kind of how we hit the sweet spot with that story. And I just love the abalone now, so.
I think all animal stories are inherently human stories, right? I mean, there's an interconnectedness there that what we're doing to the animals is going to directly affect us as well. In Florida, you see that with manatees. Like, we had a really large manatee die-off in 2021. That's a major driver of ecotourism. So the two are interconnected, right? A manatee story can directly be tied to the human experience as well.
I haven't directly looked at stories about animals in my work, but I would expect similar principles to apply, that, like, certainly humans have empathy for animals. Images of animals and stories about animals can evoke emotional responses, and so I think the same sorts of ideas would still apply there.
We had one more question over here.
Sure.
Can you introduce yourself again? I know you did before.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think one of the most important things I do is I always look at the headline with the image. because that's how most people see the story. And I think it's such a crucial thing to do, because so often if that is just slightly off, someone's gonna scroll by it, or it's going to have the opposite effect of what you want. I think one example where I had a really interesting conversation about this was, we were doing a story, which I'm sure everyone has some version of this, is, you know, do offshore wind farms impact whales, right? I think a lot of people, especially even former presidents, have made comments about how bad offshore wind is for animals. Here's another animal example for you. And, you know, we kind of just did a quick hit kind of fact check looking at this. And obviously we wanted to, yes, show the animal, but do you want to lead with that, right? We're saying no, they don't, right? There's still ongoing studies, but generally no. So I felt really strongly about leading with offshore. That is a solution of the future. That is what we should show people, and not leading with the whale. That might be a little bit more clickbaity, but it's something we toy with back and forth. I don't necessarily have the ability to change the visual for different platforms, but it is something, when I did run our Instagram account back in the day, that I was very, very conscious of, because how you convey that image with the story is, I mean, it can be everything, and in using the right relevant image and highlighting it is just so important.
Just curious, which comes first, the headline or the picture?
In the order that I'm choosing, that's an excellent question. Honestly, I typically start with the images, and I say, what is the most important? Here is how I see it. And sometimes the lead image is very obvious to me. That is it. But sometimes then what I do, obviously, before I show it to the world, is I read that headline, and then I sometimes second-guess myself, and I look at that headline, I look at the image, I look at everything else again, and I try to better coordinate what goes with that. I struggled with a story about oil in Congo, because the headline was really focused about oil in Congo, and I actually went back and forth between showing the oil and the flares and showing the people impacted by the oil and flares, and I chose the person.
Have you been forced to change the headline or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not really shy when it comes to my text friends if I see something that I think should be changed. No, absolutely. I think if the headline doesn't convey the story that I'm reading, that as a reader and a consumer, and the first line of defense before we publish it, I should feel, and every visual person should feel, compelled to speak up when they see a headline that's not matching the story intended. And like someone said, in this day and age, headlines and lead images are often evolving, and often the one that I think I put out with the first story, halfway through the day, we might try a different one to see how that engagement changes.
Thank you so much for all of these questions. We were hoping to have a little bit more of an intimate conversation with all of you in smaller groups. And so what we're proposing, because we thought a little bit about the configuration of this room, is that we're going to have folks who are in the front row and the third row turn their seats around. I'm going to ask the folks who are in the front row over here, the three of you, to come join this group. And so now over here, the second row and the fourth row will turn their chairs. So we're going to end up with basically four clusters. And Allie, Alyssa, Max, and I will come and facilitate some conversations, or hopefully you'll get to know each other a little bit better, get to know us a little bit better.